The news has been replete with accounts of young men, unarmed men of color, dying from force inflicted by police officers, followed by some coroner's conclusions of homicide and grand juries who decide not to submit the case for trial against the officers involved. Then protests around the country calling for accountability, prodding us all with the words, Black Lives Matter. Last month, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio stated in a TV interview that he and his wife, who is African American, have sat down with their son, Dante, a brown-skinned teenager, and cautioned him about how to behave around the police so as not to trigger suspicions or disproportionate actions by an officer. For this, the mayor was branded a traitor by the head of New York's police union. Since then, a violent man with an untreated mental disorder murdered the officers Wen Jian Liu and Rafael Ramos as they sat in their squad car in Brooklyn. The leader of the police union said repeatedly that the mayor had blood on his hands for having given any credibility to protests against police brutality. The mayor visited the officers' grieving families and spoke at the funerals. Many of the officers in attendance turned their backs on their city's mayor. Such disrespect surely is a sign of anguish, a sign of grief manipulated by the union leaders' words. It also shows how divided we are in these United States. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said that we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Those who have law enforcement officers in our families or friendship circles feel pain when cops are demonized. It's unfair and unhelpful. We can point to the stories of abuse by others, by teachers, business leaders, clergy, even parents. For every line of work, every profession has its share of corrupt or incompetent people. Furthermore, even competent professionals make mistakes in judgment. The difference is that we train police officers to use lethal force, and we arm them. We send them into a variety of situations, ranging from deadly, boring routines to truly deadly encounters. We ask them to take on risks that most of us would not accept. Sworn officers accept these risks, and their families live with the knowledge that encountering humanity at its worst is part of the job. Officers witness the aftermath of murders, suicides, overdoses, and traffic accidents. They take reports of sexual assault and child abuse. They must respond to every call, not knowing when their lives might be in danger. They receive calls in response to all kinds of social problems, including abuse of alcohol and other drugs, violence in the family and workplace, uncontrolled tempers, and irresponsible driving. In most cases, the police cannot prevent the social conditions that lead to a crisis. Yet when the neighbors hear a domestic argument escalate to a fight, it is the police they call. When a driver is weaving through the intersections, the police receive our call. If drugs are discovered in our schools, it is often the police who receive the call. We ask cops to be the social workers of last resort. There's one more thing, which we rarely admit. Our society asks police officers to police a society whose power structures are based on white supremacy and racial domination. It's been almost 150 years since the end of American slavery, after 400 years of it. It's been 50 years since the passage of civil rights legislation. Yet our country has not yet passed beyond the age of policing people based on the color of their skin. White supremacy and racial domination are a living legacy and a disease that continues. And all of us are caught up in a system of racial inequities. Today's police did not invent the system, but they live within it and enforce its laws. Prison guards didn't invent the system, but they police the 1 million men of color behind bars in the United States, about 40% of all our prisoners. We incarcerate a higher percentage of our people than any other democracy, and a disproportionate number of them are black and brown. 60 years ago, a teenage boy named Emmett Till went from his home in Mississippi to visit relatives, went from his home in Chicago to visit relatives in Mississippi. Emmett spoke to a white woman in her store. Maybe he flirted with her, the story goes. He was 14, she was 21. For this, he was carried out of his relative's home, tortured and shot, his body hidden in a lake. Back in Chicago, his mother insisted on an open casket so the country would see what happened. We saw that a lynching can break a family's heart, but they would be unbowed by it. Lynching was the tool of enforcement of a social code of separation and inequity. White men took the law into their own hands to enforce the code they had inherited. Of course, sometimes the lynchers were local police officers, or the police covered up a lynching and those who did it. Emmett Till's killers were found not guilty. Later, in their freedom, they did admit what they had done. A few days ago, Thursday, a black 22-year-old named Joseph Swink was arrested in St. Ann, Missouri in a case of mistaken identity. On the interstate, the police pursued a man wanted for 17 warrants. The man crashed and went down an embankment and ran away. His car had hit Joseph's. Joseph ran from his own crashed car because it was filling with smoke. When they saw nobody else, the cops chased Joseph, a college accounting student. Joseph said, "There was nobody black on the scene, just a lot of white cops. I didn't feel safe around them. I think they probably felt they could get away with it because I was black and they can do this." This refers to the bloody side of his face. Seeing this, his grandmother said, "This is all we ask of our young men, to do the right thing, become productive citizens in this country. And he's not being given that opportunity because someone has mistaken him for a criminal. That upsets me very much." For his part, Joseph said, "I'm just glad I'm still here." The chief of police has apologized. Last summer, on a street of Staten Island, New York, Eric Garner allegedly was selling cigarettes. It's a violation of civil code to sell untaxed cigarettes. This is part of New York's approach to crime prevention. Keep streets clean of scenes of petty crime. Bad guys will be less likely to commit felonies, and residents will feel more confident. Officers confronted Eric, and he was verbally resistant. The officers took him to the pavement. He cried out, "I can't breathe." He had asthma. "I can't breathe." Once subdued, Eric lay on the ground 7 minutes. Paramedics came but thought he was breathing and failed to administer CPR. The autopsy says the cause of death was compression of neck, chokehold, compression of chest, and prone positioning during physical restraint by police. The medical examiner called his death a homicide, but the grand jury did not indict the officer involved. An unarmed person who is not physically threatening or hurting another person should not be met with deadly force, but it happens frequently, too much. It does not matter whether one black man is an honor student or another is a small-time hustler or another is a flirtatious boy. Their lives matter. Black lives matter. 6 years ago, I spent a summer afternoon riding along with a City of Sacramento police officer in his squad car. 10 years ago, when I served a congregation in Silicon Valley, I went on a ride along with police in the city of Sunnyvale. All of the officers were friendly young men and open with their opinions. I felt honored that they didn't watch their language because they had a minister in the car. From them, I learned that cops enjoy every chance they have to drive at high speeds and run the siren and lights, especially on the interstate. And in addition to this excitement, I had a troubling experience. For years, people of color have said they are pulled over on suspicion of driving while black or driving while brown, racial profiling. On my Monday morning ride a decade ago, in Sunnyvale, my host officer began paying attention to a large, shiny Mercedes-Benz moving ahead of us. He kept following it. This guy's not speeding, but he has a taillight out. The officer turned on the flashing lights, the car pulled over, and so did we. The officer walked up to the driver's door and spoke. Out from the window, a large brown arm offered a driver's license. The officer brought it back and called in the driver's license number and the car's plate number. The car was a rental. The driver from North Carolina. The driver explained to the officer that he was a professional athlete with a local team, but he lived in North Carolina. The officer had not heard of the team. To my surprise, I had. It was a real team, indoor football, I recall. The officer said to me, "Well, I can't give him a ticket for a taillight on a rented car. I guess I'll tell him to point it out to the rental company." After 10 minutes, we were on our way again. Did you know that driver was black before you pulled him over? Would you have pulled him over for that if he had been white? I wish I had asked this, but I didn't have the courage. A UU minister friend of mine has worked as a volunteer chaplain to the police department in her mid-sized city in the Midwest. She loves the police and respects them for the job they do. She told me that the vast majority of police officers go into the work because they want to make the world a better place, just as we do through ministry. Most of them sense a calling to serve and protect. Yet she also wonders about racial profiling. Her experience was that the police do check the license plate numbers more often when the drivers of the cars are young African Americans. Like me, she was often shy to ask about it. In November, in Cleveland, two officers responded to a call about a guy with a gun in a park. Ohio is an open carry state, so it would not have been a violation, even if the gun had been real, but it was a pellet gun. Tamir Rice was 12 years old and black. A video shows they shot him in the abdomen 1.5 seconds after they pulled up. Tamir's sister, age 14, was playing a block away, heard the gunshots, and was told who had been shot. In the words of New York Times writer Charles M. Blow, "She raced to his aid, but as the video shows, one of the officers tackled her, handcuffed her, and stuffed her into the back of the police cruiser. Just feet away from where her brother was bleeding out onto the snow-dappled ground. Tamir died of his wound the next day." Writer Charles Blow imagines that police officers must encounter a disproportionate number of people who break the law. And we must ask to what degree that skew, the types of people they encounter, warps their perception of citizens in general. Sometimes an officer may stop a driver who's high on methamphetamines. Some suspects, though unarmed, fail to put up their hands when ordered. Yet neither action is a capital crime. Neither is worthy of death. Aren't there other ways to deal with an officer's understandable anxiety other than a shoot-first policy? How about waiting for a backup vehicle when you stop a car before you approach it? How about keeping the cruiser windows rolled all the way up and barking orders out of the loudspeaker? How about letting a few runners get away? I don't know the answers to this, of course. All I know is that every life matters. Black lives matter. In one of his songs, the hip-hop singer Michael Franti says, "If the world's full of anger and everybody's got a gun, then what should I say to my teenage son?" 3 years ago in Florida, George Zimmerman, a private citizen, killed young Trayvon Martin. Shortly thereafter, a close friend of mine in Florida spoke to his teenage sons. They're not African American, but they have brown skin and black hair. Their dad said, "Don't wear a hoodie. When you're done with school, don't stop at the 7-Eleven for Skittles. Get off the bus and come home." One of the sons is quite a talker, with a beautiful smile, boundless energy, and the confidence of a leader. His younger brother is quieter, with a thoughtful intelligence and a sweet sense of humor. I've known the older one since he was a toddler and the younger one since his birth. Wonderful young men. They are going places, clearly. But they have dark skin. They live in a society that categorizes us by color. The sky's the limit for what they can do if they can make it through the minefields of suspicion about young men with brown bodies. I am afraid of a lot of things. I have my share of dread about the state of the world. But let me tell you, if I ever have to go to a funeral for someone like them, for a reason like being in the wrong place with the wrong shade of skin, I don't know what I'll do. I don't know. I'll want to give up. Of course, that fear of mine has become a sad reality for the parents and friends of many young men with beautiful smiles and skills and promise and hope. But those grieving parents and friends mostly don't give up. They speak out. The parents of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York have called for demonstrations and called for protests to be nonviolent, in honor of their sons who died from violence. In their situation, I would want to curl up into a ball and hide for years. Yet they are able to protest, able to call for accountability, able to ask for justice, They are able to see their stories as part of a larger story in a society that still categorizes all of us by color and uses force to keep us in the lines assigned to us. Though they are grieving, they prod us. Black lives matter. So do the lives of police officers. So does every life. When I did my ride-along visits with the police officers, I heard clearly their view of the world. Those officers spoke of the world in terms of good guys and bad guys. Period. You're okay, or you're a bad guy. No gray area, no nuance. This is very understandable given the crimes they deal with and see. Yet when this view of the world is overlaid by a social structure based on white superiority, the color of your skin can put you at a disadvantage. And the flip side of this kind of good-bad thinking, either-or thinking, can show a similar stark line about the goodness of police officers, either all good or all bad, with no nuance and no attempt at empathy to understand their experience. Dr. Martin Luther King said that we, all of us, are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. This means all of us together. This means the lines dividing human groups from one another are deceptive. They are false, and they are deadly. Can we, as human beings, afford to keep dividing ourselves from one another? Yes, we can, but only if we can afford the heartbreak that comes with it.